The Guardian.
Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
This episode of Science Weekly is also brought to you by Get Into Teaching. Teaching is a career that allows you to make a real difference to young people's lives, and it's a great way to make your degree, skills, and knowledge really count. By sharing your passion for physics, chemistry, and biology with the next generation, you could get £25,000 tax-free to train, subject to availability, selected subjects only. To find out more, search Get Into Teaching and register for tailored advice to start your teaching career, or head to getintoteaching.education.gov.uk.
In New York, there stands an impressive statue of Columbus, a reminder that this is a new continent in the light of history. America not so long ago was a continent of wilderness and open space. Excitement stirred in the hearts of a multitude of men as eyes turned toward the challenge of a new land. Now America is a land of mighty cities.
In 2014, the United Nations estimated that 54% of the world's population lives in urban areas. That figure is expected to increase to 66% by 2050. But life for Homo sapiens wasn't always like this.
Practically all American cities, large and small, have a similar pattern of density.
Rewind 200,000 years and our early human ancestors were fully or semi-nomadic hunter-gatherers, often living in small communities. But what happened between then and now? Why did humans choose to live in villages and then cities? And what has this dramatic change in habitat done to our health?
Cities basically force us to adapt to the messes we've made. So putting that many humans together makes a huge mess. You know, humans are terrible people. And cities find ways of emphasizing this. So they might discourage that kind of competition and violence inside a city, but they might encourage people to acquire more material wealth so that they can be at the top of the heap.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, no, I'm excited to...
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Signal for, you know, like, do you have something to chuck at my head so I stop speaking if I'm going on too long? Or... that's something softer.
Now, delving back this far in time is no easy feat. Thankfully, we can uncover clues about our past in the bones we find.
Well, honestly, my eyes would also close, but yeah. No, I think I'll try not to fall asleep.
This is Brenna Hassett.
I'm Dr. Brenna Hassett, and I'm a bioarchaeologist and author of Built on Bones.
I sat down with Brenna in the studio this week and started by asking her, so why do you dig dead people?
I ended up fascinated by anthropology, which I didn't even know was a real thing. And I ended up taking like a sort of evening class in anthropology, and they explained all of these things about, you know, you could look at skulls and see the evolution of humans, and I just thought this was the most interesting thing in the entire world, so, you know, nothing would do, but I set off to do an endless amount of graduate study and ended up digging up dead people for a living.
In Built on Bones, you look at what happened when humans ditched the hunter-gatherer lifestyle for life in the first villages, towns, and eventually cities. Why did you want to explore that?
Well, actually, urban health is something that I'm really interested in. When I first started sort of research career, I was looking at early modern London. So my PhD is actually on London in the last 500 years, and it's looking at all of these sort of things, characteristic city things, and looking at what it does to the health of children. And it's a fascinating subject, and it's sort of, you know, health sort of underlies all of your later life chances. So I got very interested in this interplay between kind of the social evolution of humans and the actual health. And it turns out that if you dig up dead people, these are questions you can answer.
To tell this story, you have to look over more than 10,000 years of human history. I'm wondering where and when do you find the evidence for what happened? Presumably you have to look at different time points and different places to piece together what happened in these areas.
Yeah, so the book actually, I try to go as global as possible. There are places that I know better than others. I've worked in Egypt, in Turkey, in Greece, Thailand, in London. So there are things that I knew better than others, but it sort of tries to survey the global phenomenon of how we originally sort of started settling down. So you actually have to go very far back for this. And we start looking at evidence of, for instance, little structures that mark human camps, and when those structures start to turn into kind of year-round permanent settlements, and that's something that takes us way back in the past. And it also looks like it's something that at various points humans have tried and then abandoned. So we didn't always get it right the first try.
How do you know when something's a sort of permanent settlement rather than just a temporary place where people were?
Well, that is a complicated question, but you can look at the finds that, so if you go around and you dig up something and you come up with a series of post holes, archaeology's great answer, or, you know, a series of base of a sort of structure, lined stones or something like that, you can start to look at the associated finds, things like animal bones, and especially things like pollens and plant remains that will give you some indication of seasonality. But really, mostly what people are looking at is things that look like an accumulation of long-term living. So we go through your trash. That's what archaeologists do. And we see how long you haven't thrown it out.
So give us some ideas of the kinds of things that you see that tell you about this actual transition. So what sorts of things do you see in the hunter-gatherers that you see disappearing and then other things presumably emerging in these new sort of more urban types?
Well, there's a long list of things that have changed. I think everyone can picture in their minds this sort of stock photo of paleo dude. You know, there's paleo dude, there's paleo chick, and, you know, they're ripped, they've got amazing abs, they're totally healthy, you know, glossy, shiny human beings. So we have this idea of what the past looks like, but if you go through to the bones, it's not always that shiny and glossy. You know, our shiny paleo dude and paleo chick would have not made it much past 40, perhaps.
Right.
But we can look at their bones, and there are a variety of techniques that we can use to look at what they were eating and how their lifestyles were affecting their bones. So if you think about your shins, so that's your tibia, the bone you bark on a coffee table when you run into it in the middle of the night. Those are incredibly important. If you were to use some high-tech CT scanning equipment, you could look at your shin bones and look at the thickness of them. That thickness reflects a kind of use-it-or-lose-it bone philosophy, where if you use the bone a lot, if you're building a muscle on it, it gets a little bit thicker. So we see these big, fat, thick tibias in our hunter-gatherers because they're walking around a lot. They're probably more mobile. They're using their legs a lot more than people who are more settled. So we do see real physical changes in our hunter-gatherer ancestors with their big, thick legs, and our little farmers with their weedy, skinny little legs.
We'll come to the role that farmers and farming played in our evolutionary history in a little bit. Before we get there, though, as Brenner explains, the move from hunter-gatherer to fixed village settlements wasn't an instant success.
So I don't think we necessarily got it right first off. I mean, as an experimental way to live, villages more or less trap you in one place with one set of resources. So if you have a bad year, it's not as easy to sort of break away and go find food because you're pretty much limited to what you have on hand. Also, villages allow people to build up in numbers. And there's nothing worse for people than a density of people. Lots of people stuck together is, you know, terrible for people, great for disease. Mm. A lot of diseases need a reservoir of a reasonable number of people in order to keep themselves active and going. A disease would rather you did not die in an isolated field because it's no good for the disease. The disease needs you to be amongst other people so it can jump to the next host. And there's also issues of the sort of new technologies that we developed in order to make these villages work, farming and domestication of animals.
So it sounds like in the villages that people were more prone to diseases. Maybe they had more risk of starvation, or if there was a catastrophic event at that village, a flood or a landslide or something like that. What were the hunter-gatherers dying of? What were their challenges? Presumably it wasn't all, you know, great times for them.
I think it's never been all great times for any human. If you go back 200,000 years, it's sort of an issue. But hunter-gatherers, you know, they do face disease. You do have diseases that affect hunter-gatherer remains. What seems to be sort of a major issue is that survival just isn't as long. The life expectancy isn't as long. It's not to say there are no old people in the hunter-gatherer record. It's just that it's not as common. So we can suspect that that might be for many reasons. It might be that there's just a limit past which you can no longer get enough food, and you kind of don't make it. But we don't have quite the same amount of evidence for how hunter-gatherers die, or the variety of ways to die that we invent when we invent cities.
You know a lot about teeth from these dead people. What sort of information do you get from looking at old teeth?
Teeth are fossils. Teeth form once. If you break a bone, okay, you sort of put it back in place, you wait some time, it's terribly painful, but it knits together because your bone is constantly growing. There's not a bone in your body that's over about 11 years old because all the cells sort of mix up and, you know, sort of renew. If you chip a tooth, it is a very expensive prospect that will never heal itself. This is because teeth grow once, and they grow during a very critical part of your life, which is when you're a child. So they grow once, and they lock into this little fossilized structure all of the information on the chemistry of all of the things you're eating, the water you're drinking, the geology you're walking around on, and even better, like tree rings, they lock down a record of growth. So we can look at your teeth. And if you let someone like me at them with a saw and a series of slides and a microscope, I can start looking at these and give you a daily record of how you grew in childhood. You know, obviously there'd be some ethics permissions involved, but it's amazing the detailed information we can get from teeth. And teeth let us look beyond the bones. Teeth let us look at childhood when you were alive, as opposed to bones, which give us a snapshot of when you were dead.
So what sort of things are you actually pulling out from these things? Are you pulling out the diet or the, as you say, the more general health or diseases? Or
well, teeth can give you quite a lot of information. And so teeth can tell us about diet. The various different things we've eaten in our evolutionary past give us, you know, different marks and stuff on our teeth. So if you eat a diet that's full of fibers, it's going to leave microscopic scratches on your teeth. If you eat a diet that's full of hard nuts, it's going to leave little pits on your teeth. So there's all sorts of things that we can do to look at. But the thing that's really interesting with the move to cities is that we can see two different types of evidence. One is what we use our teeth for. So there's a sort of general idea that in the past, when we weren't eating nice, soft cereal foods all the time, that we, you know, carefully grew our artisanal wheats, that we had to chew a lot more. We had big, heavy jaws with big, heavy muscles. And those big, heavy jaws fit our third molar. So if you've had a wisdom tooth, you will be aware, probably, statistically, you will be aware of the pain and horror of having a third molar. Increasingly, people are born without third molars. This is something we're slowly getting rid of. But if you do have one, chances are it's going to be sort of cockeyed, askew. It's going to knock into something. It's going to be deeply painful. But this is because, quite possibly, our jaws are getting smaller. Our faces are shrinking because we have changed our diets. And we don't need those big, heavy, chewing jaws anymore.
Brenner will be the first to say that this is just one idea of how settling down might have changed us, but there are plenty of others.
And the other thing that I really look at very closely is the little records of ill health in childhood. So like tree rings, your teeth have got these records of how you grew. So if you've got a sort of bad mark, if you've got a gap in the record, we can see that something interrupted your health. And one of the things we see very early is a sign that these interruptions come at regular intervals in kids' lives. So around about 2 years, you might see that everyone in a population has a line on their teeth that indicates something happened to them. And as we get into sort of the Neolithic, these lines happen a little bit earlier in the child's life. One of the things that might be tied to is the age at which a sibling is born. So if you look at ethnographic comparison, sort of the anthropology of how you deal with a child, or if you just sort of picture this in your head, can you carry a 4-year-old and a one-year-old at the same time while walking through a rainforest? The general theory is no, not without sort of severe intervention. Hunting and gathering tends to lead to children who are further apart in birth spacing. So you'd have children actually slightly further spaced because you can't carry another child or successfully pull it back on the path or otherwise carry it. But when you get to settled life, you actually have a fixed point where you can leave multiple children with granny or your sister or whoever it is. And so we see quite a lot of evidence that birth spacing goes down. And if you have fewer years in between children, it means you have more children. And that is probably the biggest revolution that humans have ever had.
Another revolution in our history came with the domestication of animals and the invention of agriculture. But when and where did this happen?
Well, there's a couple different answers to that, depending on where you are. So in some places, the Neolithic happened 12,000 years ago, say. In some places, a lot more recently. But I think what most people are usually thinking of is, you know, the first one, which tends to be in the Near East, thinking about the development of sort of wheat-based agriculture. And there's a couple interesting new bits of information coming about. It looks like people may have started attempting to farm or at least cultivate cereal grains possibly as much as about 22,000 years ago, but then given it up. And we see a couple different things in the archaeological record. For instance, in the book I talk about the Natufians, and the Natufians seem to have settled down but then given that up. So there are a couple different false starts, probably. But I think what most people think of as the real Neolithic revolution happens around sort of 11,000 years ago. And this is the sort of people controlling the source of their food through agriculture. With animals, it's a very interesting, complicated story again, and it depends on where you are, what you domesticated. You know, if you haven't got goats to hand domesticate, you're going to domesticate something else. But what a lot of people think of is, again, the very early start, which is probably the earliest domestication of animals, which is, again, in the Near East. And that's possibly a little bit later, possibly around 10,000 years.
And how do those time points feed into urbanization?
Well, it's a slow and steady climb. I think people like the idea of revolutions. Oh, we invented something. You know, just because you invented cities doesn't mean you're all going to go live in them tomorrow. And the same applies to Neolithic villages. Okay, well, you've got your settled down life, and it takes another 1,000 years to sort out what you're going to do with it. So the site I work at in central Turkey, which is called Ashıklıhöyük, and you can see through the evidence at Ashıklıhöyük the very slow, gradual process of domestication. So when we're out there and they're digging up animal bones, they can slowly see in the animal bones the changes in the actual animals that sort of reveal that they're being held on site, stabled on site. But it's a long process. It's a sort of, you know, we've got 1,000 years of occupation and they didn't come up with these things overnight.
While these changes came with obvious advantages, after this short break, we'll hear how they also led to structural changes within the societies we live in.
One is that in order to organize the number of human beings that you have squashed together in these permanent settlements, is you actually need probably some sort of organizing principle, and that starts to look a lot like a hierarchy.
And we'll also hear how our newly found urban lifestyle isn't always for the best.
So cities are these kind of great engines that move people and goods, and they interconnect. They sort of, you know, you need a city to trade with another city. So we start to see really these networks of connected cities and the things that they send through those trade routes, through the sea lanes, through the roads, are disease.
We'll be right back.
Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianScience to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
If your mattress is more than 8 years old, then its best days are probably behind it. But shopping for a new mattress is such a pain, right? Well, Lisa's here to change all that. No more showrooms, no more commission-driven salesmen, no more delivery people with muddy boots lugging it up your stairs. The Lisa is a luxury mattress with three unique foam layers to help you stay cool and comfortable and wake up totally refreshed. You can try your new Lisa for 100 nights completely risk-free, and if you don't love your new mattress, Lisa will pick it up and arrange for a full refund. Check out the range for yourself at lisa.co.uk/guardian and get £80 off your new mattress by entering the offer code GUARDIAN80 at the checkout. That's lesa.co.uk/guardian. The Lisa mattress, a better place to sleep.
Before we kick off again, I wanted to recommend another of our podcasts here at The Guardian called Politics Weekly. Each week, The Guardian's politics team unwind the political spin and delve into the key issues that drive the people in power. Recent episodes include a 2017 budget special, a look at the options for a reunited Labour Party, and reactions to the SNP's call for a second independence referendum. To subscribe to The Guardian's Politics Weekly podcast, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from bioarchaeologist and author Brenna Hassett about our ancestors' change in lifestyle from hunter-gatherers to urban dwellers, a move that led to our domestication of animals and the invention of agriculture.
Yes.
And something that Brenna postulates in her new book, Built on Bones, is that this change in lifestyle spawned an all-too-familiar obsession with material wealth.
Well, there's sort of a couple different things at work. One is that in order to organise the number of human beings that you have squashed together in these permanent settlements, is you actually need probably some sort of organising principle, and that starts to look a lot like a hierarchy. Now, if you've got a hierarchy, you've got to sort of be able to enforce that hierarchy in some way, and one of the things that you can do is flash your material wealth, is accumulate and display your material wealth. So as we get into the very beginnings of urban life, we start to see the rise of huge displays of material wealth, and we start to see basically the beginnings of mass inequalities in urban life.
And when are we talking? I'm sure it's different in different places, but whenabouts is this happening?
So if we're sticking with our Near Eastern earliest phase, then it's probably about 5,000 years ago that we really see this fluorescence of urban life. And we start to see huge, huge stockpiles of material wealth. So one of the sites that I work at in southeastern Turkey is amazing. It has just got more beads than you could possibly shake a stick at. It has so many bronzes, they haven't bothered to unwrap them. They are literally still in textiles, wrapped up in little bundles to be buried with the dead, because who could be bothered unboxing them? So it's a really amazing sort of transition from the early villages, if we think about places like Şıklıhöyük or Çatalhöyük, which have some personal ornamentation and some sort of little storage bins, to, you know, the graves, which, you know, people are putting in hordes of bronze, hordes of beads, and even hordes of dead people.
But with this desire for material wealth came competition, a kind of competition that historically would have been settled through violence.
Cities basically force us to adapt to the messes we've made. So putting that many humans together makes a huge mess. You know, we're not, humans are terrible people. And cities find ways of emphasizing this. So they might discourage that kind of competition and violence inside a city, but they might encourage people to acquire more material wealth so that they can be at the top of the heap.
Do you see more signs of violence amid the remains of the urban types than you would in the hunter-gatherers? And is it just a numbers game?
This is actually one of the really big hot topics in anthropology right now. So many people would argue that cities have led to our downfall and that we are a terrible, terrible species on a terrible, terrible arc. I'm not sure we're not a terrible species, but crucially, we might be getting better. I think there is some reason for optimism. So if you think of war, a lot of people will sort of go, oh, well, war is a cities thing and war is terrible. So obviously cities are terrible. But actually, we've been killing each other for a lot longer. And there's evidence, for instance, of massacres, complete massacres, entire communities wiped out, arrowheads embedded, people's skulls bashed. From 10,000 years ago, shores of Lake Turkana, these are hunter-gatherers, presumably killed by other hunter-gatherers. There's lots of evidence of early farming communities being totally obliterated. Germany and Austria have a lot of evidence for this, these huge mass death pits where we find the broken bones and smashed tibias and all sorts of horrible things. So we're not quite sure if we're getting worse or better, but it's obvious that in the past, there was quite a lot of violence, and it could wipe out an entire community. So there's arguments that have been made that a more organized violence, which is what you get in a sort of urban state system, kills fewer people as a percentage of the population than something that wipes out huge portions of community.
It would seem then that the jury is still somewhat out on whether violence has declined. What seems less unsure, though, is the effect that moving to cities had on the health of our ancestors. In the final parts of the book, you look at what you call the final and fatal consequences of living in a densely populated world. What are some of these consequences? Is it really that bad?
Well, I think certainly over the last, say, 2,000 years or something, you could get pretty serious consequences. I think everyone agrees syphilis is a terrible idea. And things like plague don't happen without the connections that cities need to survive. So cities are these kind of great engines that move people and goods, and they interconnect. They sort of, you know, you need a city to trade with another city. So we start to see really these networks of connected cities and the things that they send through those trade routes, through the sea lanes, through the roads, are disease. We, you know, by connecting ourselves to the rest of the world, it turns out we've connected ourselves to a bunch of diseases who are extremely grateful for the opportunity.
And what are some of the examples that play out in history?
Well, you can certainly look at things like plague. Everybody loves plague, except for bioarchaeologists, because plague kills you fast, which is no good for us, because it doesn't leave anything in your bones for us to know that it's plague. All we get are massive pits full of dead people. But now we do have ADNA testing, ancient DNA testing, so that is much handier. But plague is something that obviously would never have made it out of Central Asia if we hadn't had nice trade routes into Europe where it could infect a new and naive population.
What diseases do leave a mark on the bones there?
Anything that takes a long time to kill you is going to be a fast favorite of bioarchaeologists. So length of time of disease tends to leave an effect on the bone. So leprosy, which is a very lengthy process. We do notice when the toes and fingers fall off. That is a pretty good sign. One of the things that gets a lot of attention, partially because it's horrible, but partially because it is very noticeable in the skeleton, is syphilis.
And what does that look like in a skeleton?
Once you get to third stage syphilis, the infection has got into your bones. So depending on kind of your normal health status, it might take 30 years to get that way. But once it gets into the bone, it is not a good scene. Essentially, it sort of starts to eat away quite a lot of the bone with infections. You might have a lot of sort of open sores that are on top of bone that's basically being eaten away. So by the time you look at the skull, you've got a sort of Swiss cheese-looking thing. It looks quite a lot. If you were to take chewing gum and harden it on a sidewalk, that's pretty much what your skull would look like. And it doesn't help that they try to cure it with mercury.
And it's more than just plague and syphilis in the city's repertoire for affecting human health. Modern changes in our lifestyle mean that conditions like diabetes are now among the world's most serious health challenges. A recent estimate claims that by 2040, more than 500 million people will suffer from it. Moving into our increasingly urban future, what else can we expect?
It's not clear that we have solved all of the problems of cities. I think we still have quite a lot of issues, and a lot of them are, you know, ones that we've caused ourselves, the sort of pollution, the sort of results of the success of the city almost, because there are so many people moving in. You get things like wage differentials and people working in jobs that really just don't pay enough to live. And you get buildup of pollution in the same way that the streets of New York were covered in, you know, horse manure a century ago. We've got diesel particulates floating around the air. But I think what we can sort of look at as a sort of vague optimism is that our mechanisms for dealing with these problems, we now have them in place. We actually do have newspapers writing about the outrage of, you know, diesel pollution. We have universities and institutes that are studying air pollution and how to solve it. We have global initiatives to reduce wage inequality, health inequality. So there are, in the very cities that are causing the problems, there are also the engines, hopefully, of our salvation. Though I am really worried about the air pollution.
A lot of the chapters in your book are named after songs, so I have to ask you, should we stay or should we go?
You know, I'm a city girl, so I think we've got to stay.
Special thanks this week to Brenna Hassett. We'll include a link to Brenna's wonderful book, Built on Bones, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.